Good evening and welcome to tonight's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program brought to you from the Oshman JCC in Palo Alto. My name is Lisa Krieger. I cover science and medicine for the San Jose Mercury News. It's my pleasure to introduce our speakers this evening, Dr. Burton Richter and Dr. Norbert Holtkamp. But first, we're pleased to have the new director of the SLAC National Accelerator Laboratory with us this evening. Dr. Cal? No? Dr. Cal is on his way. So here's Dr. Richter. He's professor of physical sciences at Stanford University and director emeritus of the SLAC National Accelerator Laboratory. He received his doctorate from MIT and began his postdoctoral work at Stanford University in 1956, becoming a professor 1 year later. As a professor at Stanford, he constructed and used the Spear Particle Accelerator to discover a new subatomic particle for which he was jointly awarded the 1976 Nobel Prize in Physics. He served on numerous advisory committees to governments, labs, and universities, including the Secretary of Energy Advisory Board, the Nuclear Energy Task Force, and he's chaired the National Research Council's Board on Physics and Astronomy. Currently, he chairs the Transmutation Subcommittee of the Nuclear Energy Advisory Committee, and he serves on the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab Advisory Board. He's a recipient of the E.O. Lawrence Medal of the Department of Energy, and in 2012, President Obama named Dr. Richter as a co-recipient of the Enrico Fermi Award. We also have Dr. Norbert Holtkamp, who's the Associate Lab Director for SLAC. Dr. Holtkamp received his Ph.D. in physics from Darmstadt Technical University in Berlin in 1990. He began his postdoctoral work at Germany's largest research center for particle physics, where he led the linear accelerator department. He was a senior staff member at the Fermi National Accelerator Lab and at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, where he led a team of five national labs in the construction of the accelerator for the spallation neutron source. Prior to joining SLAC, Dr. Holtkamp was deputy general of the International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor in France, and he's responsible for the technical management of one of the largest science projects in the world. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Richter and Dr. Holtkamp. So, Dr. Richter will start us off this evening delivering his remarks.
Well, thanks. I have the job of talking about the last 50 years, and then my colleague Norbert Holtkamp talks about the future. So what this is called is 50 years on the frontier. We're talking about a laboratory that was at its time the largest civilian science project ever built. It was the first $100 million project. It was built to do a certain kind of research, and it started off doing that, and it now does lots more things. Laboratories that stand still become obsolete, and the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center certainly didn't stand still. It's the world leader in some of the things it does. It's among the world leaders in others of the things it does. And everything that it does is first-rate. Science is mostly incremental. What we do is we add to the funds of knowledge, and by doing that, we learn more about nature. But sometimes you make revolutions, and SLAC has seen four revolutions done by people working at its facilities, coming up with four Nobel Prizes. Pretty good for a little lab. Anyway, there are three intertwined stories to be told. One is the story of the accelerators. The accelerators were the original driving force to create the lab, and it's one of the places where SLAC has always been among the world leaders. The second of the threads is high energy physics. This is the study of energy, the ultimate structure of matter, and the fate of the universe. It's done with accelerators, it's done in space, and it's done on the ground. This was the exclusive science focus of the laboratory when it started. Photon science, where work here has now opened up new fields of basic and applied science, is the area where now we are the unquestioned world leader, and everybody's struggling to catch up with us. So I'm going to start and go through some of these stories, and I want to begin with the origins of the lab, which go back to the year that I came to Stanford as a brand new postdoc. I was not involved in the very high level things going on, but there were four people who were already plotting the future of the high energy physics at the lab. Those were W.K.H. Panofsky, known as P.F. Panofsky, who was the director of high energy physics lab on campus with an accelerator. It was pretty big. It was 300 feet long. It's almost as long as a football field. Bob Hofstadter, whose experiments on the size of the proton were already exciting a great deal of interest. Leonard Schiff, the chairman of the department, and Felix Bloch, the one Nobel laureate at Stanford at the time. Hofstadter's work had excited great interest, and in fact, he got the Nobel Prize for that work in 1961. And these four started thinking about how to build a really big machine from 300 feet long to 10,000 feet long. And with that, to probe much more deeply into the fundamental structure of matter. It was called the Monster, informally. A first proposal went to Washington in 1957. Eisenhower announced his support for the project in 1959. The contract with Stanford trustees for this first $100 million project was signed in 62, and we were on our way. The first beam was in 1966. You can't do that today. You can't go from a gleam in the eye to a running machine in that amount of time. There are too many reviews. There are too much bureaucracy. There are too many milestones. And it takes a lot longer, but it could be done fast. Now, those of you who live down here on the peninsula have probably driven along 280 and crossed the accelerator, and you see this big 2-mile-long building. It's the world's longest building, but it's not the accelerator. The accelerator is buried 25 feet underground for radiation shielding, and the real accelerator is a copper tube that's 4 inches in diameter, 10,000 feet long, and a hole in that tube about 3/4 of an inch in diameter, and that's where the beam is accelerated to very high energy. It sits on top of a big support tube, but that's it. Now, for a university, this was an unusual adventure. Universities usually talk about equipment for their own faculty, but the first $100 million accelerator was not going to be a facility just for physicists at Stanford. It was going to be open to all the physicists in the United States and, in fact, to the physicists in the world. When it started, we had about a few hundred outside users coming in to make proposals to use time on the machine. Today, there are 3,000 that use the accelerators every year. That includes people who not only use the stuff on site, but there is a satellite that Slack runs circling the Earth. And we have a big international group that built it. There are other things on the ground, underground. And our accelerators have multiplied. There are 5 of them. The original one is still running. It's used for things. But there are 4 more, and that's all part of the story. So let me go start with the high-energy physics experiments, and not only was the accelerator big, but the apparatus was big, too. These were not little experiments that you did in laboratories. The pieces of equipment weighed hundreds of tons, and they towered over the people who used them. The first experiment turned into one of those transformative experiments. Yes, it went further than Bob Hofstadter had gone in the looking at the size of the proton, but it did much more than that, too. It discovered that the proton really had substructure. The theorists had a model which said that there was substructure, but the theorists said that this was a theoretical way of classifying. But what this first experiment did was it showed that there were genuine things inside this little proton. One of our theorists, Sidney Drell, said there are seeds in the grapes. That was a big deal. That was the first of Slack's home runs, and that was the first of our Nobel Prize-worthy experiments. The Nobel Prize for that work wasn't awarded till 1990, even though the work was done earlier. But even while that experiment was going on, the next accelerator was being built, and that next accelerator produced more in the way of transformations. It was a new kind of accelerator. Instead of this long thing colliding very high-energy electrons with targets at rest in the laboratory, it collided two beams circulating around in a magnet in opposite direction. And those two beams were particle and antiparticle. And you could collide them, and every once in a while, particle and antiparticle would annihilate. You get what I always thought of as a fireball in a tiny region of space, and from that fireball could be born anything that was possible to create that was consistent with the conservation of energy. Construction of that started in 1970, and that was completed in only 20 months. And the first 3 years of operation of that facility turned physics on its head. There again was not only a new kind of machine, a colliding beam machine, but a new kind of detector too. This detector surrounded the collision point and looked at everything that came out all at the same time. So you could see all the particles that were born from that little fireball. It's interesting that this, at the time, was the largest group working in particle physics on a single experiment. There were 27 people in that group, including all the graduate students. Today, you've all heard about the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. Typically, there are over 3,000 collaborators in each of its two big detectors. It's a change in scale, not only in energy, but in the size of the detector, and in the size of the collaboration. The next Nobel Prize came from work at that facility, and it's mine, by the way. I'm prepared to talk for hours about that, but I'm not going to. And what was found was a particle that wasn't allowed to exist by the then theoretical model. It lived 100,000 times longer than the then theoretical model of the ultimate structure of matter said that something that heavy was allowed to live. Nothing like it was allowed in particle physics. And interestingly enough, the same effect was found in an accelerator on the other side of the country at the Brookhaven National Laboratory in a completely different experiment. They were published back-to-back in the same issue of PhysRev Letters. Instant confirmation, no question about repeating it. It was there, and it came to be called the November Revolution and changed the view of the subatomic world. And in 1976, Sam Ting, who was leader of the East Coast experiment, and I shared the Nobel Prize in Physics. The very next year, Martin Pearl, working on the same experiment, found an entirely new family of elementary constituents of matter. When the Ting and Richter experiments were done, there were two families. Pearl discovered the third family. one more experiment done in Europe established what came to be called the standard model of particle physics, and ever since, people have been trying to find out what's beyond that standard model. So by the late 1970s, the standard model was established, and the standard model stands today, and everybody's trying to find what more there is. Maybe the new facility at CERN will do it. There are several more machines, larger machines built at SLAC in the colliding beam world. I'm not going to spend any particular amount of time on them. I want to go on and talk about the next to the last machine that was built. But before I go to the next to the last machine, I want to turn to the origins of the third thread, which was synchrotron radiation. In 1971, two professors came to talk to me as I was building that Spear storage ring. One was from the Department of Applied Physics, Sebastian Doniak. The other was Bill Spicer from Electrical Engineering. And they said that if we would let the X-rays that were generated in this storage ring by the beam going around, if we let them out, they promised to revolutionize condensed matter physics, which was what they were interested in. I took two people, Gerard Fisher, could we do it, and Ed Garwin. Solid-state physics was not my bag. I said, should we do it? And Fisher said yes, and Garwin said yes. And again, it was a different world. I didn't ask the Department of Energy. I didn't need to go to any place to go get permission to do it. We just did it. And we built, there it is. We built, modified one section of the ring to let the beam out. And what happened was that Doniak and Spicer had been too modest. This beam of X-rays was a million times the intensity you could get out of any X-ray tube. And with that much new intensity, you could do all sorts of things. And so it was not only in solid-state physics, but it was in structural biology and chemistry and environmental sciences and materials and lots of other fields that it made its own revolution. It started parasitically. It just took data when the high-energy physics experiment was run. It became 50% dedicated to this photon science stuff in 1979, 100% dedicated in 1988. It was upgraded in 1992, upgraded again in 2004. And the second upgrade was half paid for by the National Institutes of Health because it had had such an impact on structural biology, where X-ray diffraction could tell you about biologically important molecules. It, too, produced one of the Nobel Prizes, Roger Kornberg in chemistry, for his studies of how the process that is used to copy DNA and synthesize protons and how that worked. That old machine is still there. It's like the Cheshire Cat. There's nothing left but the smile. In this case, there's nothing left but the shielding blocks. Everything else is new, and it still is oversubscribed. One other machine I want to talk about is something called a linear collider. High-energy physics was still important to the accelerator business, and the machines kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But because of the behavior of electrons and positrons getting bent around in circles and emitting X-rays, the size of the machine went up as a square of the energy. The minimum cost machine, if you wanted twice the energy, had to be four times as big. So if you wanted to go 10 times up from the then biggest, you had to go from 27 kilometers around to 2,700 kilometers around, and that's far too expensive for anybody to consider. So a few of us at a meeting got together and designed what's called a linear collider, wrote down how to build one, This is now two linear accelerators colliding with each other. It scales as the energy goes up as the first power of the energy. So at some point, it's got to be a lot cheaper than one that scales as the second power. At Slack, we paid a trick. You could use one of the LINAC, and you use the LINAC and bend it around. So you could try this out with a single LINAC instead of with two. And so we did it, and it made its contributions to high-energy physics, but it also made contributions to the developing the first X-ray laser in the world. At the end of the LINAC, that beam comes out, and it goes, and it's wiggled through a bunch of magnets, and emitted from that is a coherent beam of X-rays. And once again, Slack moved on to the frontier. The world is trying to catch up. There are a lot more of these X-ray lasers being built. We've got the first one. It produces so much that the DOE is already given the money to upgrade it. The lab also does other things in the accelerator-based one. This is the launch of a satellite. The satellite was done by NASA, but the payload was done by an international collaboration led by Slack. This is now circling around. It looks at very high energy gamma rays from all sorts of sources, whether they be black holes or star jets or what have you. And Slack is also taking the lead in developing a new camera for a telescope that's designed to do a survey of the universe and find out about such things as dark matter and dark energy. And there, again, you have a lab where the technology has broader applications than anything we originally thought of. So if you look at the present, Slack is now, I would say, about two-thirds photon science and one-third high-energy physics. It used to be it started as 100% high-energy physics and no photon science. It's now moving into energy. It's got an institute to study catalysis. It's looking at ultra-fast chemical reactions. It's looking at how you make holograms of biologically important molecules so you can take a snapshot and license a hologram. You can go look at it in all sorts of directions. The big issue now for the laboratory is what's the next big thing? The next big thing is going to take 15 years to do because you got to think about it first and then you got to design it. And now it takes a lot longer in the United States to do anything than it took when I was sort of growing up and when I was running the laboratory. And with that, I turn the discussion of the future over to my colleague, Norbert Holkamp.
Thank you very much. So can you give me the clicker? Thank you. Okay, so dear members of the Commonwealth Club, dear guests, dear ladies and gentlemen, it's a real pleasure to be here tonight and share with you some of the ideas and thoughts and the vision of what Slack looks like today and how it will look like in the future and what Slack might do in the future. Let me just bring up a few pictures here. Here we go. So thank you, Burton, for explaining how we got to where we are. And thanks to you and your leadership and the vision of your predecessors and your successors who have helped to lay out the groundwork for what has become the most exciting facility and will be the most exciting facility for decades to come. Just to give you a little bit more context before I launch with you into the future of Slack. Slack is one of 10 national laboratories mainly funded by the Department of Energy. They are scattered around the country, and the DOE Office of Science spends approximately $5 billion on research each year. At Slack, this amounts to about $350 million per year. In addition to the annual operating budget, major investments in the laboratory over the past and present decades amount to more than $1 billion. 1,700 people are employed at Slack, and over 3,000 people from all over the world use our research infrastructure every year to advance basic and applied science. To spend these $350 million taxpayer dollars wisely, we have to define and continuously refine what we want to be and where we want to go. Bert talked about this a little bit. It changes all the time. If a laboratory stands, you know, it dies. So here's where we are today. There are areas in which we at Slack lead the nation and maybe the world, and we want to continue to do so. One of those areas is photon science, and I'll talk a lot more about it. Burton alluded to them. It's science which uses intense beams of X-ray light to explore matter at very small and very fast scales. We also want to build on our particle physics expertise because it's intriguing science and we are good at it. We want to pursue strategic programs in particle physics in the future, and I'll show you a few of those. And finally, we at Slack want to continue to be the nation's premier accelerator laboratory and develop the tools and the instruments that make it possible to do the science we are so good at. We believe accelerators are key to this success. They make it possible to do experiments in health, environmental science, energy, homeland security, high energy physics, defense, and other important areas of society. At Slack, we explore the universe at the very largest and the very smallest scale. And we investigate processes that range from the very long to the very short. The instruments that we build allow us to do that, and some of them are very unique. John Etchemendy, the provost of Stanford University, cited this passage from the book Instruments and Imagination and the Imagination by Thomas Hankins and Robert Silverman on the occasion of the inauguration of Slack's X-ray laser in 2009. Instruments have a life of their own. They do not merely follow theory. Often they determine theory because instruments determine what is possible, and what is possible determines to a large extent what can be thought. Interesting view, isn't it? From the Big Bang that created the universe 14 billion years ago to the present day, and from the cosmic scale of galaxies to the incredibly small quantum world, if we look at the experiments that provided the insights we have today, we realize how much our understanding of the world, our health, and our prosperity and our future relate to Hankins and Silverman's statement. I would extend this to say that our ability to create the world we want depends very much on technological advancements that allow us to build new and better instruments. No place should be more sympathetic to this idea than Silicon Valley. Let's start with the very large and the very small. In our language, we call this the cosmic frontier and the energy frontier. And while the frontiers in science are all intertwined, Slack focuses on these two when we talk about strategic programs. The standard model of fundamental particles and forces, for which Slack delivered several pieces, as Professor Richter explained, and Slack and Stanford won a few well-deserved Nobel Prizes, has been holding up now for more than three decades. It's one of the most successful models ever created for describing and predicting nature, and recently it was confirmed again with the discovery of the Higgs boson. All of you have heard about the Higgs boson, a particle that explains why particles have mass. It was discovered with the world's largest scientific instrument, the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in Geneva. These experiments are part of the energy frontier, where scientists slam particles into each other at higher and higher energies to create particles known only from the first moments of the universe. While people at Slack and around the U.S. are deeply involved in using the LHC, the U.S. does not lead this frontier of physics anymore. It might be a little frustrating, but it doesn't take away from the tremendous achievement made in Geneva. At the same time, it's not over yet. Since the demand for higher and higher energy particle collisions will continue, as long as our picture of the fundamental building blocks is incomplete, we have not seen the unification of the forces yet. Slack accelerator scientists, together with colleagues at Stanford and Berkeley, are working on new technologies that will allow us to eventually recapture our leadership position. Our ultimate goal is to greatly reduce the size of linear accelerators so we can do what Slack's TumaLinux does today with a device that's approximately 3 feet long. This will take time and money, but ultimately it will allow us to push ahead to higher energies at lower cost. When an intense packet of electrons or a very intense laser pulse is forced through a metallic vapor, it drives the electrons quickly away from the remaining ions, which are too heavy to move as fast, creating a wake like a boat in the water. While ramming through a 1-meter-long chamber with a vapor inside, an incredibly large electric field, up to 40 gigavolts over 3 feet, is created in its wake, which stretches only a few micrometer behind. 40 gigavolts in 1 meter. That is similar to the Slack Linux today. Is that even possible? Can we utilize this field reliably? Well, an experiment at Slack has already proven that it can be done, although more work is needed. This line of research is as important for industry as it is for academia, since accelerators are used for a wide range of industrial and medical applications. Now let's turn to the cosmic frontier, where scientists use the universe as a laboratory. The standard model has been very successful indeed, but scientists observing the cosmos at very large scales, the very large, very, very large, got a big surprise. The ordinary matter that they had so thoroughly researched during the last 100 years or so makes up only 4% of the matter of the universe. This is the matter that makes up you and me, the things around us, the planets and the stars and the galaxies. Just imagine when you walk out tonight, next time you look up into the night sky observing these stars. Only 4% of what you see, or what we see with the most sophisticated instruments that we have, can be explained with the physics we understand so far. 22% of the rest is called dark matter, which is responsible for the forming of galaxies and planets since the early days of the universe. And 74% we call dark energy, which is accelerating the expansion of the universe. Again, it's the tools and the instruments that we build that allow us to make these discoveries. Slack is at the forefront of this work. While we presently don't lead on the energy frontier, the U.S. still owns the cosmic frontier. And Slack is pushing this frontier with the tool it builds, with the tools it builds. In collaboration with NASA, Slack developed the main instrument for Fermi, for the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope, which launched in 2008. It's a camera that watches the universe with gamma ray eyes. Gamma rays are the most energetic form of light, very high energy X-rays. And amazingly enough, the universe looks very different in gamma rays, giving us a glimpse of where the most active and most massive galaxies are. The telescope has been feeding data to our researchers at Slack and the Kavli Institute on our site. And from there, it made available to scientists, it's made available to scientists all over the world who use it to explore the mysteries of dark energy and dark matter and how they interplay with the matter that we know. The next instrument is already on the way, the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope. It's under construction and will be installed on a mountaintop in Chile. It will map the sky with an unprecedented level of detail, Slack leading the collaboration. Since we just heard from an example of where X-rays are very useful to disentangle mysteries of the universe, it's a good time to start telling you about Slack's second stronghold, which is photons. Photon science done with X-rays. Everybody knows X-rays from the doctor's office, where they are used for diagnostics or cancer treatment, or from going to the dentist, from airports, or maybe from harbors, where they're used for cargo scanning. All very practical examples, including one of my favorite stories from Persis Drell, Slack's former director, who recently stepped down. When her son, who was a curious little boy back then, swallowed a quarter, X-rays revealed its location, and with no further risk detected, the problem literally disappeared in a matter of days. In science, X-rays are used to determine the structure of molecules, mostly when crystallized, such as the double helix structure of DNA that was discovered in the 50s. They are short wavelengths, short compared to the molecular structure, reflect from the atoms of a regular lattice, and their ability to penetrate material make X-rays a formidable all-purpose tool used by more than 30,000 scientists around the world, in academia and in industry. Two major facilities at Slack provide these X-rays. X-rays help answer questions about how living things work. They are important tools for developing drugs in the pharmaceutical industry, big business today. We also use X-rays to find out how materials behave on an atomic scale, so we can design better materials for improving computers, computer hard drives, electric cars, batteries, advanced solar cells, even quantum computers, maintaining our nation's technical leadership in this area. High brightness is a key performance parameter and essential to unlocking these mysteries. For comparison, imagine the light beam from a lighthouse. It shines the brightest when all the light comes from one point going to only one direction with no divergence. Similar with an X-ray source shining on a sample. Having the brightest light source often determines who is first to unlock the ever more complex structures we are interested in. Objects we look at in X-ray science are much smaller than a quarter. Crystallized molecules can be just 1/10 to 1/100 the width of a human hair. Sometimes we look at structures comprised of only a few atoms. Being able to shine as much X-ray light as possible onto such a sample is key to seeing its structure. But if the exposure takes too long, maybe the sample deteriorates, or while we shine on it, the structure itself changes because X-rays damage the crystal. For decades, we have invented, built, and operated light sources, and their brightness has increased with dramatic speed, more than twice as fast as the improvements in integrated circuits described by Moore's law, where over the history of computing hardware, the number of transistors on integrated circuits doubles approximately every 2 years. On top of that, in 2009, we opened an X-ray laser at Slack called the Linacoherent Light Source. With the start of the LCLS, the X-ray laser at Slack, we did not only improve but jump in brightness from one day to the next by almost 9 orders of magnitude. For comparison, just imagine today all you earn is $1 and you have to live on it. Tomorrow you make $1 billion. How many more things can you do? The excitement among scientists at Slack and around the world who suddenly have that much more light available for their experiments is very similar, even though their income is far less than $1 billion, I promise. This new laser, the only one in the world until last April when a Japanese facility turned on, and still the only one to reach these unprecedented intensities, is the instrument of a lifetime. Not only does it shine brighter than anything we knew before, but the light comes in incredibly short flashes, so short that we can almost see electrons move. We can certainly see chemical reactions happen step by step, follow spin flips, or see atoms oscillate. The ability to discriminate between events happening very close together in time was always worth some money. Again, a comparison. In the 19th century, there was a controversy in horse racing circles about whether a galloping horse ever lifts all four hoofs off the ground. Most people believed a horse always has one hoof in contact with the ground, but Lead and Stanford disagreed. In 1872, Stanford offered Edward Muybridge, a world-famous photographer, $25,000 to find the answer. Muybridge wasn't sure he could build the right instrument to settle the dispute, but he agreed to take on the challenge, placing cameras at a distance of a few feet, proving Stanford's point right. State-of-the-art X-ray research facilities like Slack's Stanford Synchronization Light Source can document changes in samples occurring in just a picosecond. That's a millionth of a millionth of a second. The X-ray laser can even do better, reaching down to the timescale of chemical and biological reactions in a cell. The future of photon science, of new materials, new drugs, will be driven by the desire to observe and manipulate the ultra-fast timescales, the nanometer length scale of atoms, and the energy scale of weak interactions that hold electrons in motion with their closest neighbors. And now we have the instrument with all the features we need. We have the brightness, we have the ultra short, we have the X-rays, and on top of all of that, the light is coherent and focused into a laser beam. Slack is pretty much pregnant with the scientific revolution. It's just a matter of time until the baby is born. But how does it work? The electrons that make the light are born on a copper surface every time the X-ray laser fires. They are then manipulated and accelerated by applying a voltage of 12 billion volts. The electron packets are compressed in space and time until they're only 15 micrometers long, which is equivalent to 50 femtoseconds, 50 millionths of a billionth of a second. This is the shutter time of the laser. The electrons travel on a curving path through an array of magnets, forcing them to emit X-ray light, photons. The photons and the electrons move both at the speed of light, interacting with each other. After a while, the electrons are then forced to radiate at only one frequency. Like chirping cicadas, when they get in sync, the noise becomes overwhelming. Similar, the electrons, now all radiating at the same wavelengths, emit more and more X-ray photons at exactly the same frequency. The laser light is born. When the laser beam hits a virus, for example, the light is so intense and so bright, it is so coherent and in so short a pulse that it can make an image of a whole virus in its natural state. Why? The photons have scattered off the virus before the electrons in the virus really have time to move. They form a pattern in the detector before the intensity of the laser beam makes the virus explode. And since this is laser light, the two-dimensional pattern frozen in the detector allows us to reconstruct a three-dimensional object. It's like a hologram. Will this help us the next 10, 20 years to unravel mysteries? If you believe so, let me tell you about another puzzle. So what's this puzzle? Nobody has ever explained it better than James Stewart, who did this in his 1938 movie, You Can't Take It With You. So I won't even try.
I remember in college, another guy and I had an idea to... Mind if I talk about myself?
If you don't, I will.
Well, this guy and I had this idea. We wanted to find out what made the grass grow green. Now, that sounds silly and everything, but it's the biggest research problem in the world today, and I'll tell you why. Because there's a tiny little engine in the green of this grass and in the green of the trees that has the mysterious gift of being able to take energy from the rays of the sun and store it up. You see, that's how the heat and power in coal and oil and wood is stored up. Well, we thought if we could find the secret of all those millions of little engines in this green stuff, we can make big ones. And then we could take all the power we could ever need right from the sun's rays, you see?
Well, that's wonderful. I never knew that.
Yeah. Well, we worked on it and worked. Well, day and night, we got so excited we forgot to sleep. If we make just one little discovery, we'd walk on air for days.
Yeah.
So, what a beautiful description. As you heard from Mr. Stewart, understanding this little green engine would revolutionize our world. This is today even more true than it was in 1938, when nobody knew about oil crises or global warming. We all believe we understand photosynthesis, since we learned it in school. Water, CO2, and sunshine are going in. Sugar and oxygen are coming out. How difficult can that be? Difficult enough that we have, as of today, not really understood how it works. If we could figure it out, we might be able to harness this knowledge to create a new way to generate clean energy. Let me be honest, I'm not sure that we will solve this problem. But we might. We believe we have the instrument to do so, but who knows whether we will be successful. Because of what LCLS has already achieved, and because this technology shows so much potential for future discoveries, the DOE's Office of Science has approved $405 million for construction of a second laser. Referring back to what James Stewart said about walking on air, should you see a few people doing that at SLAC anytime soon, you will know why. Let me close with a few remarks on technology. First of all, looking back at the investment of $114 million that created SLAC in 1962, I would say that the return has been tremendous. I hope people will say the same thing 50 years from now when they look back at the $350 million per year invested today. The construction of SLAC was a quantum step in accelerated technology, and this entrepreneurial approach must be kept alive to create the instruments for the future that we want and need. In addition, accelerated technology has created a business market of at least $5 billion, of which at least half of it is right here in the Silicon Valley. Varian provides more than 60% of the cancer therapy machines in the world, and these machines are accelerators by nature. Detector technology, compact beam binding systems, food irradiation, sterilization, compact cargo scanners, the list goes on and on. I hope with all of this I've given you a glimpse into the future of what SLAC can contribute to it. Predictions are difficult, especially about the future. But when you hear about SLAC in the next couple of years, look back and what we said here today, wish us luck in achieving our goal of producing outstanding science and inventing the technology that will get us there. Thank you for your attention.
Stand up.
The new director of SLAC.
Introduce the new director of SLAC. Come on up. So thank you very much. Fascinating presentations. There were rumors circulating, and those of us who love science, that all the big questions have been answered and that the age of great discoveries are behind us. Clearly that's not the case, and it's really exciting to hear of our successes, but also what some of the really big unanswered questions in physics are now. Several good questions, and one of them actually relates to that, and I'll start with you, Dr. Richter. You had mentioned that we had a standard model of physics, but it was incomplete, and that you're hoping to find out more, and you can address this as well. What more is there? And maybe you could describe, the question is, what's the real structure of a proton behind the standard model?
Well, the real structure of the proton, that's not a difficult question anymore. There are three of those little quarks in it, and they keep exchanging the quanta of forces of a strong force. And so we understand the proton. But Norbert alluded to the two biggest questions in cosmic physics now. What is dark matter? What is dark energy? It is astonishing. This is only 15 years old. 15 years ago, we thought that ordinary matter was it. And then we found first that it wasn't, that there's all this dark matter that contributes to the forces that hold galaxies together. And then we found that there's this mysterious stuff called dark energy, which is the thing that's pushing the universe to accelerate faster. And as Norbert said, all the work we've done so far is on 4% of the energy density of the universe. There's an awful lot to do. That's the cosmic thing. And he also alluded to a whole bunch of questions that are not quite so cosmic, but are on a more human scale that have to do with actually matter as we see it and matter as we move it and how catalysis works and how biological molecules work. There's a lot to do and a lot to go on.
And what might what we learn about dark energy and dark matter explain about the creation of the universe, the formation of the universe?
So, as Professor Richter said, it's only 15 years old. It caught scientists by surprise. It wasn't clear. And it's largely an observational technique right now. The instruments that we built observe the universe, and they measure that the accelerator, that the universe accelerates faster and faster. It blows apart forever. And that's something that, you know, we would like to understand. At the same time, without, you know, again from observational techniques, we know today that without this mysterious dark matter, the galaxies wouldn't have formed the way they form. They would not develop the way they develop. There must be something out there, and today we cannot explain it. The goal, of course, with all of this is, at the end, going from observation to theory to experiment, meaning the best thing that could happen to us, we find a way, we have an idea in the future on how we can create this mysterious dark matter or dark energy on Earth with an experiment, maybe an accelerator experiment. maybe something else.
There are hypotheses on what the dark matter is. And one of the things one hopes to see from this big accelerator at CERN is the production of heavy particles that have the properties of strong gravity, but otherwise hide themselves and don't interact in the standard way. The CERN machine has only been running for a couple of years, and it hasn't found them. That simply says they're a little bit heavier, but the energy of that machine is going to double 2 years from now, and then maybe we'll find them, and maybe we won't.
Which relates, there's a question related to that. Now that the Higgs boson has been discovered, what's next in the large-scale accelerators? You described a three-foot accelerator. What's required to better understand the Higgs and potentially understand new physics?
I mean, what are we looking for with these accelerators?
I guess he's asking. They're asking, what is the next generation in accelerators, maybe even...
Well, the next generation in proton accelerators is coming along. The technology is here. The CERN machine is going to increase its intensity by a factor of five by about 2020, and they're looking at how to double its energy again in about 2030. And Norbert talked about the electron machines, where you're going to get the same energy as the 10,000-foot slack produces in 3 feet, and that's going to let the electron-positron machines grow up too. But that's his bag.
Anything you'd like to add?
Well, there's things we can do. It depends on what the question is. Today we don't know exactly how much energy we need. And nobody is willing to take a multi-billion-dollar
bet. We're never going to know that one.
That's probably true. Nobody's going to take a multi-billion-dollar bet really at this point. So, what we push at SLAC very hard is technology that we know. But looking in the next 20, 30 years, this technology will come to a natural end, because the techniques and the technology is getting too expensive. Just scaling it up. So there's got to be something else coming. And this something else is the intriguing part that gets the young scientists going in our laboratory on what is it that we can contribute in terms of an experiment. And that's what I try to show with the plasma wakefield acceleration. If we could conceive an accelerator like this, make it work, make it function, and then add on to it, it would allow us to reach an energy scale similar to the LHC, beyond the LHC, and probably reach to what we need to know when we talk about dark energy, dark matter, and the particles that we want to look for.
I'm busy crossing my fingers.
Good.
I read a science fiction story when I was much younger, and something in the first page of that book has always stuck in my mind. It said, we no longer do high-energy physics or optical astronomy because the instruments had become too expensive. Okay, now, the scientists produced the first revolution with colliding beams, which suddenly got the energy much higher, and Norbert is charged to produce the second one. I did my part. You do your part now.
Speaking of frontiers, there's a question with respect to string theory. Are there any experiments going on at SLAC directed towards investigating string theory?
You can't. String theory has no experimental consequences. I have challenged the string theorists more times than I can conceive of to give me an experiment that will say whether string theory is right. And so far, they haven't come up with any experiments to do. So, to me, string theory right now is philosophy, not physics.
So
that's perfectly okay.
Experimentally. It's not provable experimentally.
Not yet, but maybe somebody's going to have a good idea. There are other things in physics which, when the ideas were originally thought of, there were no experimental tests. But then over some years, between the experimenters and theorists, experimental tests were devised.
So maybe what would need to happen to make that What would need to happen in terms of the engineering or the tools or to make that possible?
It's not an engineering question. It's what physical consequences does string theory have? String theory has extra dimensions. So you can now look on a very small scale. Do we have more than three space dimensions? People have looked. The answer is, as hard as they can look, they can't find them. Maybe they're there. Maybe you can find them. But right now, philosophy.
It's like everything in physics, right? Physics is observation. Then you write down what you observe. Then you make a construct, a model of what this what you have seen. This model is used to make a prediction, and this prediction has to be experimentally verified. I think what you're describing, you know, that step hasn't been taken yet, right? So somebody has to come and take that model, make a prediction, and so we can design an experiment around it. That prediction we're looking for.
Thank you. Perhaps a related question, that's the mystery of the expanding universe. The question is, will Slack help solve the question of the expanding universe? In other words, why is the expansion speeding up? Will the universe eventually collapse in on itself? Or will it just expand forever? Or something else will happen, totally unexpected?
When Einstein invented general relativity, he put in something called a cosmological constant. And a cosmological constant was a tunable constant. If it was zero, then the acceleration of the universe was constant. The expansion wouldn't speed up. If it's minus one, it will speed up forever. And the present measurement is it's 0.98 plus or minus 0.03 minus. So right now it's consistent with general relativity. And general relativity says that's the way it is. And we've done a lot of tests of general relativity. And there are a lot of experiments going on, this time with satellites and in the sky and such, to try and nail down that parameter better. And the experimental measure is what is the rate at which the expansion is accelerating. General relativity makes a prediction for what that rate is. And we're pretty close to its prediction.
I'll bring us back here to Earth a little bit, if
okay.
we could.
Good.
Thank you.
You're sorry you asked that.
Thank you. Dr. Richter, energy policy. Has our approach to nuclear energy or our philosophy regarding nuclear energy changed in the wake of Japan's Fukushima crisis? And I'll let you address that first.
Well, before Fukushima, everybody was predicting that there was going to be a big expansion of nuclear. Why do you want a big expansion of nuclear? It doesn't emit greenhouse gases. It lets you do a lot of energy with a very small amount of fuel. The fuel loading in a reactor, you put in this much uranium and you get as much energy out as you deliver from 10,000 freight cars full of coal. So it's a very good thing. Then along came Fukushima. Now, what's the problem with Fukushima? There has been a recent report from the Japanese committee set up by their Diet, their parliament, and I've never read anything like it. It said Fukushima's entirely human-caused, and its cause was the government and the industry not obeying their own regulations. It really condemns it, and that's why Fukushima happened. Now, how bad was Fukushima? I got asked to comment on the loss of life from radiation, so I did a little work. And so I did the following exercise. I said, okay, suppose you'd never had a nuclear power plant at Fukushima. Suppose you generated the same amount of electricity with coal. You had had five times the number of deaths as you had at Fukushima from both normal operation and from the accident itself. The Japanese notion to convert back to coal and such is crazy from their health point of view. And I really don't know what they're going to do. I think the important issue here is to take a lesson in proper regulation. And what you saw was India made their regulators independent. China has. We, for some reason that I don't understand, our Congress was very wise in 1975 and made our regulators independent, and there we are.
Thank you. Final question, how can we encourage the next generation of scientists to follow in your great footsteps?
Norbert.
That's easy. Curiosity. You know, that's nothing is more curious than children, right? So children need to be taught curiosity, asking questions, and then trying to find answers to questions, even if they sound crazy. Go out there, look into the sky, imagine there's only 4% you understand. That's a good question for an adult. But there's other questions that come to children. Education is another one. Very, very important. I come from Germany, and probably it's true all over the world. Very often in the educational piece of science in school is not the one that most attention is being paid to. Not the best people go there and do it. And that's where people lose interest. That's where people go off and say, oh, yeah, you know, physics, I did that too in school. It was terrible. So that's when people lose curiosity, they lose interest in science, and then they're not going to become scientists. So that's the most important thing to breed.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Hope you enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we'd like to thank Dr. Burton Richter, Nobel Prize-winning physicist and director emeritus at Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, and Dr. Norbert Holtkamp, associate lab director, and our audience here in Palo Alto and those of you joining us on the radio. Thank you. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned, celebrating 100 years of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much.